are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, we start with an essay by Mark Porter Zasada called Celebration of Chaos. Then Bach's Sonata No. 1, The Fugue, performed by our featured guest, Chihei Chung, on percussion. Then my interview with Chihei. Then she performs Velocities, again on percussion. And we wrap up the show with another performance of that same Bach Sonata No. 1, The Fugue, by Hilary Hahn on violin. Stay tuned!
This is Mark Porter Zasada with Stay Human, a search for the mystery, poetry, and sometimes beautiful conundrums of modern life. Today, I'm talking about chaos. It's a topic on a lot of people's minds these days, as the delicate balance between civilization and disorder seems, well, a bit off. The other day, a Facebook friend of mine posted that poem by William Butler Yeats from 1919. You know the one. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. The poem seemed, again, apt. I don't know about you, but when I was a child, I often hoped for chaos. Lying in bed, I would imagine that a catastrophe would visit my little suburban town. A flood, a hurricane, an earthquake, Godzilla. Everything would be turned upside down, and among other adventures, I wouldn't have to go to school. I didn't imagine injuries or deaths, just chaos. Anything to change everything. From what I've read, this didn't make my childhood self a sociopath, or even unusual. I mean, look at any young child or teen, and you will see that desire for some kind of chaos. You'll see it's apparently inborn. Of course, when most of us reach adulthood, we hope that only sociopaths wish for actual catastrophes. But the desire for at least a little chaos, well, it does seem to stay with us. Parties should be a little wild. Art should disrupt norms. Politicians should upset apple carts. Hidden forces should sometimes be released. Civilizations should be overturned. It's always interesting to me that chaos became celebrated in art only sometime in the Romantic era, around the beginning of the 19th century. It was downright revolutionary when poets like Wordsworth went out and celebrated the chaos of a waterfall or a storm. By now, we're so used to the idea that art should celebrate chaos and disrupt the orderliness of social assumptions that we forget that was not the purpose of art for the previous 14,000-odd years of civilization which preceded the modern era. You can't make absolute statements, of course, but for whatever thousand years, most art seems to have been pretty much about celebrating and perpetuating the underlying orderliness of civilization, of religion, of nature. Think of Egyptian art, which seems to the layperson almost not to have changed for thousands of years. Seriously, only an expert can tell the difference between eras 1,000 years apart in Egyptian art. Can you imagine that? Art not changing for 1,000 years? The same is true of most traditional cultures, right? Africa, India, indigenous tribes. Maybe that's because humans sort of depended on their culture to hold back the chaos and the darkness of night just outside their doors. So celebrating the orderliness of culture and religion seemed, well, you know, duh. After the Romantics and the Expressionists, well, the celebration of chaos grew among an elite cognoscenti who understood Joyce, Stravinsky, Matisse, Picasso, but chaos really went mainstream in the 1950s with Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Jackson Pollock, free jazz, de Kooning. Heck, go online and watch those electrifying first appearances of Elvis in like 1956. As a commentator at the time put it, Elvis doesn't just seem exciting. He seems dangerous. The man was, very literally, shaking things up. After that, well, you know, the 60s, punk, the works. It isn't hard to find quotes celebrating chaos. "Chaos is a friend of mine," said Bob Dylan. Well, yeah. "In chaos, there is fertility," said Anais Nin. Sure. It's not my job to discuss art. I'm just trying to understand my own head. How I got to this point with everyone else. Nowadays, if art doesn't challenge the underlying assumptions of culture, it can hardly be called fine art. If a movie or TV show does not include rebellion, it probably won't get greenlit. I mean, why bother? The cop who refuses to follow the rules, kids who refuse to follow the rules, starship captains who refuse to follow the rules. In fact, it's pretty hard to imagine a movie in which the hero succeeds by following the rules. Imagine an artist in our time saying, "I am celebrating the underlying orderliness of civilization." No politician comes to power by saying, "I represent the lack of change." Even though for untold thousands of years, that was the ticket to success in both art and politics. But of course, maintaining civilization, or even maintaining your own brief existence on Earth, or that of your family, is actually a lot about following the rules. It's a lot about thwarting rebellion, and certainly chaos. Driving on the right side of the road, not embezzling at work, not slugging your neighbor if his tree drops leaves on your side of the fence, not leading a flash mob to snatch and grab at Walgreens, not attacking the Capitol to overturn an election, not overrunning borders. Indeed, to maintain a civilization, a family, a life, requires not just a certain respect, but even a certain affection for orderliness, cleanliness, predictability. You gotta want to keep things at least mostly sane to survive at all. When you get kids, among the basic things you have to teach them from a very young age is to abjure chaos. You have to teach them that life is in many respects an endless battle against entropy. From the spilled glass of orange juice to the mounting pile of dirty laundry to sibling fights. Then later yet, to not embrace chaos by quitting their jobs every time a boss frowns at them. Anyone with kids know how they sense the brief power they have when they generate chaos. And anyone with kids knows that when they grow up, it will be their job to bottle and control chaos, even if they go into art or entertainment or its close cousin, politics. I mean, even in a Hollywood movie, no matter how rogue the cop, the resolution usually comes when the bad guy goes to jail. Otherwise, such movies really would be celebrating chaos. We have to teach our kids that the chaotic art of, say, a Jean-Michel Basquiat is really only attractive when it is hung in a clean, orderly gallery with air conditioning and guards. There's some kind of balance required, right? But why are humans, especially young humans, drawn to chaos at all? There must be a reason we so wholeheartedly praise the disruptors of politics, of music, art, industry. Indeed, these days we pretty much only praise the disruptors, the rebels, the resistors. Maybe it's because we think that the human experiment, like all the experiments of nature, and like our own individual lives, requires disruption to progress. And progress matters more than anything, right? Keep a job more than 5 years and your friends will tell you it's time to move on. Keep a politician in for more than 5 years and they're probably out of touch. Use a technology more than 6 months and hey, you're old school. But that's pablum, really. That's the stuff of corporate posters embracing change. That's ignoring the powerful emotional appeal of chaos itself, the sheer direct power that orderliness finds hard to beat. It's ignoring the joy on a warrior's face. Picture a playroom. On one side of the playroom, a child exercises their newfound human prowess by carefully constructing a symmetrical tower of blocks. Maybe it takes an hour. But on the other side of the room sits a child who cannot resist exerting equal or greater power simply by crawling across the room, pushing the tower over, and scattering the blocks in less than a second. It's a thrill, right? Almost irresistible to a small child, destroying in a moment what took a long time to build. Human powers have been equalized, or even, let me use the forbidden word, trumped. Just like that. The same is true for, say, terrorists. A busload of passengers have spent decades building up meaningful, complex lives, say 30 passengers averaging 30 years old. Collectively, that's 900 years of human effort. No kidding. The bus itself required exquisite human skill and technology to construct, the work of generations. Engine, electrical systems, safety systems. It takes enormous effort, always, to build things. Buildings, lives, democracies. But hey, look how a bomb can reduce it all to entropy, to nothingness, in 3 seconds. The terrifying truth is that in any moment of destruction, of murder, comes a horrible kind of equality of power. Hence, I suppose, the appeal. When I was a young man, I had a close friend who lived in Pakistan. I visited him in Islamabad. He was a groomsman at my wedding. It was a lovely friendship until the events of 9/11, and our very last conversation occurred a few days after the Twin Towers came down. When I called him a few days after 9/11, he showed great empathy, not for the victims, but for bin Laden and the Taliban. I expressed my disappointment. We argued. At the end of the call, I said I hoped that someday our sons would not be facing each other across a barricade. And then I said I hoped we could agree that the people who build things should always be respected above the people who destroy things. He did not answer. He literally did not answer. I heard only silence across the international phone lines. We never spoke again. And 22 years later, his silence still rings in my ears. And I'm still not sure, 22 years later, if our sons will not someday face each other across a barricade. Indeed, as in that terrifying poem by Yeats, when I read the news, I find that basic agreement more and more rare. I mean, the agreement that the people who build things should always be respected above the people who destroy things. Instead, I always hear, shake things up. I hear it on the left. I hear it on the right. Now, you may think I'm overstating the problem. You may say, pish-posh. Like you said, Mark, all progress depends on destroying one thing to make way to the next. Old customs, old roles. You may say it's a yin-yang sort of deal. Order, chaos, order, chaos. And change, well, change should always be in the air. In the U.S., as I speak, the word conservative has strangely come to mean someone who wishes to break up the existing order. But so does progressive. Both have come to mean breaking up any existing order. This follows the prevailing wisdom that says, never settle, never accept anything as enough. Celebrate chaos. You know, it's almost as if, as Freud suggested, the desire to destroy is built into our nature in the same way that destruction is built into the fabric of the material universe. You know, insects, plagues, earthquakes, storms, volcanoes, floods, supernovas, stars colliding, black holes slowly consuming the galaxies that spin around them. Indeed, you have to say that one of the major projects of religion is to convince us, and perhaps convince God, that God is opposed to chaos, that God wishes to promote stability, a single truth, that he wishes to create a world in which everyone dresses the same and believes the same, you know, against all evidence to the contrary in the way that God actually constructed the world. How he must laugh at such efforts. How God, who is the builder and destroyer of lives, cultures, religions, worlds, and solar systems, built and destroyed every nanosecond around the universe, must laugh at any attempt to judge everything on the basis of a single truth. So hard does religion work to create this vision of God that it often starts horrific, chaotic wars just to really drive home its point about stable, warm, unchanging societies. We want to believe that God hates chaos. But from the evidence at hand, does God hate chaos? I believe in God, and trust me, I really want to believe that God is the great ordering principle, and if we adhere to his revealed ordering principles, all would be well. But when I was a child, who put that wish for chaos in my head? And how is it that we humans, for whom an orderly society is not just beneficial, but necessary to our survival, how is it that we're never content with order? Or at least, not anymore. How is it that we just cannot get along? In the Bible, God begins creating the universe not from nothing, but by moving across the waters, working from, in the Hebrew, tohu vavohu. In English, chaos and void, to create earth, stars, life. The Bible never says God ceased creating, by the way. Just that he started creating. It doesn't mention that tohu vavohu is a continuing operation, perhaps necessary to the continuing act of creation itself. I mean, ask any artist about that. Scientists tell us that the whole universe moves toward entropy and simplicity, except for life, which builds complexity and order. But if that's true, how is it that the highest form of life so often goes out of its way to create entropy? Really? Think how strange it is that even sex, the actual procreative act of life, the thing that organizes cells and fights entropy, is itself fraught with such chaos, such thrashing about, such a lack of restraint, such an escape from the orderliness of everyday life, and not just in our species. How is chaos so intimate to the very act of creation? Indeed, you could say that the entire project of humankind is to fight the entropy, not just inherent in the universe we occupy, but built into our own natures. And it's pretty scary to think that the highest priority of God may not be stability, but evolution. Pretty scary to think that he likes evolution to keep accelerating, even at, literally, breakneck speed. I mean, maybe. Nobody knows. I once read that in no time in the history of humankind has there been fewer than 30 wars underway. Really? Just now, two pretty large wars are underway. Wars that threaten to, you know, get beyond local disputes about neighbors and fences. Even if you are listening to this little essay 50 or 100 years from now, that news is probably current. Those who start wars don't really mean to bring chaos, I suppose. Always they believe they are building something new by destroying something else. And it might be true, of course, if often they don't know what they're actually creating, the results of chaos being unpredictable. If I were to ask my fellow humans, warriors, politicians, artists, to consider one question, it would be this. How can you walk up to the line between order and chaos without destroying more than you build? If you step back and look closely at what we are creating in art, relationships, sex, politics, war, social media, artificial intelligence, and, well, everything, you have to say that we are exploring that thin line in the same way that an amateur acrobat walks a tightrope, ready to fall at any moment. Aristotle, who charted the course for much of human progress, spoke of following the golden mean between two extremes. Those who advocate calcification are surely wrong. Those who advocate chaos are surely wrong. Walking the line between those extremes has always been the only sure way to stay human. In fact, I'll go further. The middle path is probably the only way to beat natural selection at its own game. Today, I walked along the beach toward the end of a windy day, right at the surf line. the ocean angry with foaming swells and waves crisscrossing each other in undecipherable patterns. I'm a sailor of small sailboats, and trust me, I live for windy days. The ocean full of drama and life, the boat flying along, but not too windy and wild. Just enough. Just enough. Probably like you, I love that the ocean is the beginning and ending of all life on Earth, coming and going second by second in each cubic centimeter of salt water, microscopically and macroscopically in infinite abandon, order and disorder interchanging in such rapid progression that we can never fully conceive of the drama underway. And yet, in the end, it does remain the ocean, recognizable as sea, shores, waves, and sky. Despite the turmoil, the greater form remains. In this way, apparently, our universe and our species are doomed to move forward together. Our job? I guess it's our job to push our little boats out across that ocean, singly or in fleets, raising our defiant and often beautiful sails of human purpose. Then, well, to try and steer those little boats toward the good, as best we can, across the ceaseless and unforgiving chaos of creation. This has been Mark Porter Zasada with Staying Human. You can find me at stayinghuman.net. Thank you.
It's December 19th, 2023. Mystic Pete here talking with Jihe Chung, an innovative percussionist. Hello and welcome.
Hi, I'm Jihe. I'm so thankful to be here today talking to Peter. I'm a percussionist, which means that I create sounds on various multiple objects, and I'm not really married to one instrument, we'll say. In this concert in January, I will perform a piece that it requires my body to create many different kinds of sound.
So I see that you are an expert in the marimba. I've watched some of your videos. Beautiful, poetic approach. So I'm guessing that may be one of your major instruments, but you play your body. I'm familiar with body playing through something in Americana called hambone. But that's of particular interest. Explain what you do and how you evolved this method.
You're right. I do have a favorite instrument in the percussion instrument world. Marimba is my favorite instrument that allows my musical voice to come out and share with the audience. And I think that that's been very natural for me since I started that instrument very young. I was born and raised in Korea, and I started marimba when I was 4 years old. And I think that really opened my door to be close to that particular one instrument. And since then, I learned to play many different kinds of instruments, and naturally playing contemporary music as a percussionist, we tend to gravitate because that's all we have, working with a living composer, creating new works. And we are not afraid to play something that is totally new and maybe a little disturbing.
In the classical genre, percussion is usually the beat. It's kind of a background instrument. It's really not featured that often. But in contemporary music, sometimes it's all percussion. It's a lot of innovation.
Yes, and we are so excited. I'm thrilled to live in this era because a lot of my composer friends, they are excited to write for percussion if they already haven't, and they are excited to work with us because we like to master their works and perform many times.
Tell me about this series coming up with Camerata Pacifica.
These upcoming concerts with the Camerata Pacifica, I'll be playing two solo works. It's highly unusual that I play solos more than one piece for concerts because we often program chamber music in Camerata Pacifica. But this concert, I think our artistic director, Adrian Spence, had envisioned different kinds of another unique set of program where I will come up play this highly unusual piece, Corporal by Global Car, and I will end the concert with the Fertility Rites by Christos Haitis.
And this is just a solo percussion piece, both of them?
Correct.
Do you know the composers?
Not personally. I don't know these two composers personally, but I'm getting to know them very well through their
music. Yeah, through their music, through their creations. So yes. How do people find their way into contemporary music? Sometimes it's challenging for the modern listener who's used to Mozart and Beethoven, you know, very accessible melodies and harmonies. A lot of times contemporary music is, well, you said it can be disturbing or atonal, or, I mean, it's challenging for me at times, and, you know, I'm Mystic Pete, for heaven's sakes.
No, it's challenging for musicians too, because we live in a time where we don't just play one kind of music, right? In Baroque era, like, we played one very particular music that was regulated, and people expect to hear a certain kind of music and understood each other's musical language. But now we live in a world where anything is acceptable, right? My friends writing tonal music and my friends writing something not tonal, friends who are writing theatrical piece. So I think that for musicians, our job is to understand what the intention of the composers are and bring that out to the audience. So for audience, I will say, come with an open-minded and you need to experience the performance, just like you would do with any other set of musical experience. And if you do that, if you come with an open-minded, and maybe you will be swept away with something that you didn't expect.
So it sounds like there's a certain relaxation you have to come to the experience with, and an open-mindedness, so you can just receive, even if it is challenging or disturbing or totally new. I mean, even in pop music, there's the chorus and the verse. The chorus is repeated over and over and over and over ad nauseum, and it's something that the listener can kind of come back to, the familiar. So this isn't a 3-minute piece, but we want to hear familiarity. We want something we can sing along to. But in these modern pieces, sometimes there's absolutely nothing we can hang on to. It's completely novel and perhaps upsetting.
Mm-hmm. And that is okay too. I think, you know, that feeling, the emotions, especially with this piece, Global Card, like it is not something that we like to celebrate. Like this emotion that composer is trying to bring out, it's raw. It's like the human nature that we all share. Maybe we don't like to share. We like to maybe hide, but he bring them out, but we all have them. And it's vulnerable to perform something that has those kind of emotion. But I think that people will connect.
Well, I think you've just mentioned one way in, and that's the emotion. So, like, if we can relax our linear brain in trying to figure it out and make sense of it and just understand this is actually a manifestation, a physical creation of emotion at some level.
Yes.
That's a way to connect. Now, by the way, like, people who love new music are going to love this anyway. So I'm speaking to people now who, like, I just want to hear my Bach, you know, Brandenburg concertos. I'm trying to give people a doorway into really coming and relaxing and appreciating something that, well, it's going to be different. So emotion is one way in.
Yes, definitely. This piece has emotion ups and down. In musical work, any work that we listen, we love, it has tension. Musical tension and release. And I love that this piece, it's got all of that. This piece starts with very tense and maybe shocking, but he gives you a chance to also connect and release that tension.
So perhaps shocking, but also a resolution. It takes you on a journey.
Exactly. And for example, in this particular piece, he gives you very unusual setting of performer performing on their body. And maybe that's shocking. No instruments coming out, striking the performer's body in different ways, making sound. But then he will give here and there of release, maybe comical release of just everyday doing, like some yarning, some singing, some spoken texts. So there are moments in the right place where people need that release, and the composer gives you that.
Let's get to this playing the body issue in a second, but I want to just seize by the horns the concern of new music. Do they have to like it all? What if they don't like something?
That's totally okay.
Okay. So we're not forced to like everything.
No. I mean, to be brutally honest with you, I don't fall in with the music I perform right away either. it's not like love in first sight. I think for me, studying music, there are different. It grows from appreciation to familiar to, oh, I want to share this with people. This is new. Maybe this idea is good, or this emotion is good, or this piece makes you think of something different. So for me, it grows from that small to bigger love.
I like the way you're explaining it. I mean, just like any new experience or going to a new, you're traveling and you don't quite like this location, but if you can kind of enjoy the journey, relax and maybe deal with some shock and I don't like it, but after a while you may find your way into it and it may really be revelatory at times, I guess. You find your way in as a musician, maybe playing something for the first time, huh?
Yeah, of course. And you're right. You don't have to like it. After the concert, you don't have to hum along. You don't have to sing. But maybe you will remember that performance.
Let's talk about how you play your bow. What actually, you were saying you were yawning, and please explain.
Really, every sound that you can make, so sound that you can make with a mouth, a lot of different sound that he gives you, the letter t, k, p, and starts with a percussive sound with skull to your face, to your neck, chest, abdomen, the legs, the feet. And at some point, the performer lays on the ground on the stage and stomping and, yeah, just striking your body in different ways to create the drama on the stage.
Very interesting. So a lot of vocalizations, but also a lot of banging on your physical form. And it sounds like it's a real, that's an exploration, a whole lot of new modalities.
Yeah, I think the composer Globokar is jazz musician looking for new sound into improvisation. In this piece, particular piece, has very, it's very well detailed score. You're gonna, if you see, you happen to get the score in front of you, but I found that this piece is beautiful because it's very, very detailed score, yet every person's performance are completely different. Just imagine your skull sound striking your skull or your vocalization, it's gonna be very different sounding than mine. So you're gonna see every performers have different kinds of approach to the piece.
Well, now you're making me want to see it because it just sounds interesting. And we're in this Christmas period where I can't walk into a store without hearing the same 10 Christmas tunes over and over and over. And while I think Mariah Carey is a great musician, I'm really, I'm having violent thoughts already. No, not just kidding. But yeah, something, a new experience. Tell us about yourself a little bit. What are you up to? Do you compose? I know you're teaching. And what's in your future? Big question.
I love performing. I love sharing through my teaching. And I don't compose, but I recently have done a little bit of dabbing, of arranging some of the Korean folk songs into marimba etude books to help the younger students to master their techniques on marimba using Korean folk songs. So I was very, it's just a small thing that I've done, the small projects, but it brings me so much joy. I never knew that composing and doing things like arranging could bring so much joy in my life. I'm currently teaching at the university in Nashville, Vanderbilt University. I teach students who major in percussion and help them perform, experience performance, And not only, like, my goal is not only making them better musicians, but through music, I hope that they will be a better person, better human, to help the world a little bit better.
So you take it to a very personal level, and it's a complete soul experience.
You have to be a musician, right? As you know.
You mentioned bringing back Korean folk melodies and tapping into your roots. You know, Mystic Pete, I'm into kind of this mystical stuff. And I've looked into Korean shamanism a little bit. I'm not sure what the actual name is, but there's a deep well of material in Korean spirituality through the arts. I mean, really like trance-inspired kind of music making that's, I found very moving. I don't understand it, but I get it. I know what's happening here.
I don't perform those kind of music either, but I connect with those music as well. And during my sabbatical, spring of 2023, I went back to Korea and spent my whole semester, 4 months, studying Korean traditional music here. And it's been such a eye-opening of learning my own culture and heritage. And I was never taught while I was in Korea. So it's been really blessing to come back and connect with the musicians here.
It seems like in Korean culture, they can go full on pop, but there's also a deep side that's really deep and very soulful. I'm very attracted to the culture and finding out more about it myself.
Yes, it's incredible. I'm still in Korea performing. I just finished the performance yesterday, playing with the orchestra in my hometown. And I was playing concerto. It was great because my parents got to see it. They never get to see my performances. So it was special for my parents to come see my performance, what I do. But it's incredible. The audiences, they are all young people. It's packed with a young generation, my age or even younger. People bring their dates to concert. And I love that. I missed it. And a lot of students, young kids. And it was vibrant.
So the complaint that classical music is only attracting the gray hairs and the old people, well, play new music and you'll get a new audience. It's a very good point. Where can people find you? What's your website and so forth?
I have a website, jihepercussion.com, J-I-H-Y-E, percussion.com.
That's where people can find you. Very well. Any final thoughts or words?
No, thank you for having me, Peter. I enjoy talking with you. It's early here in Korea, 7 a.m., but I really enjoyed it.
See, you're in studio, but you're in Korea. That's what we can do in 2023.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started today's show with an essay by Mark Porter Zasada, Celebration of Chaos. Very strong piece. Then, Bach Sonata No. 1, The Fugue, performed by our featured guest, Chihe Chung, on percussion. Then my interview with Chihe. Then she performed Velocities, again on percussion. And we just wrapped things up with another performance of that same Bach Sonata No. 1 Fugue by Hilary Hahn. We'll be back next week with the Mystic Pete Chronicles, featuring the finest of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!